Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is our great pleasure to present an expert in bonobos this hour of the program. I've been looking forward to this ever since I've known about her for a long time, and we've interviewed her before, but Gay Edwards Reinarts was featured recently in a newspaper article about her work with bonobos. She's a professional zoologist. She has many years of practical experience developing and directing conservation and research programs for the bonobo. She spends half the year in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and she's been directing there the Bonobo and Congo Biodiversity Initiative, which is a research and conservation program that's in a national park, and she does that for the Zoological Society of Milwaukee. This really is all-encompassing because it deals with improving the lives of the people who live in that region so that the territory, the habitat of the bonobo won't be as endangered and they will not be hunted. It's just wonderful to see her work with these bonobos, and she probably knows more about them than anybody else in the whole wide world. So it's our pleasure to have Gay with us this hour and to welcome your phone calls as well. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hi, Gay. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, well, it's my pleasure. Yeah. Thank you.
I think about you and I see you. You're sitting here in our studios in Milwaukee, but I see you in the Congo, and I think what an extraordinarily interesting and involved life you've had, huh?
I've been very fortunate, very, very fortunate.
Tell me about the first bonobo you ever met, because that must have been quite an experience, and it guided the work that you've done for years now.
It did, and the very first bonobo that I saw came to the Milwaukee County Zoo, and that was, I think, in 1984 or 1985, and there were seven that came to the zoo, and I was instrumental in getting them to the zoo at the time because they were coming from a zoo that was shutting down in Wassenaar, the Netherlands, and my expertise at the time had been to do pedigree analysis, and there was a need for some justification to bring them to the zoo. These are endangered species, so trade in endangered species is illegal, and so we had to get permits and special permission from different governments involved in the transaction to bring them into the United States. So the justification at the time was that the bloodlines were greatly needed in the United States. The bonobos were rare, and an infusion of this of different lineages would enable us then to create a breeding program that was later called the Bonobo Species Survival Plan. So the bonobos came to Milwaukee with a purpose as to form the foundation for the bonobo breeding program. But that was the first time I had seen a bonobo, and of course they're very much like chimpanzees, but immediately you could tell great differences in the two species, their playfulness and their vocalizations, their intelligence that were already very striking just the first evening that I observed them.
And they are indeed our closest relative?
Along with chimpanzees, the genus together, Pan paniscus being the bonobo, and Pan troglodytes is the chimpanzees, so they're very closely related. So those two together form our closest living relatives, mm-hmm. genetically.
And how did the work go from Milwaukee to the Democratic Republic of Congo, where you now spend half the year?
Well, that was a natural outgrowth of working with the zoos in North America. And once we got organized and the breeding program off the ground and we developed husbandry techniques for keeping bonobos in captivity, and one of our many aims was to preserve the genetic diversity of the bonobos in captivity, we felt that the breeding program was on its way, but what point was that if bonobos had no conservation in their country of origin? which is the Democratic Republic of Congo. What's the point of keeping bonobos in captivity if everything in the wild, if it's not somehow feeding back and strengthening the conservation of wild species? So the Zoological Society was of Milwaukee was first and foremost to begin to forge relationships with people in Congo who were involved in conservation at the time, but there weren't very many because this it was in the 1990s, and this was a very troubled time for Congo. So many of the researchers who were on the ground at that time, trying desperately to get their PhD work and to formulate plans for conservation, it was a troubled politically, a troubled time for Congo. So much of their work periodically had to be abandoned. I just entered the world, this world, at an opportune time, just as President Mobutu was dying. There was a new leader on the horizon, which turned out to be Kabila, Lawrence Kabila, and he took over the country in 1997. That's when he started, when he arrived in Kinshasa. And that was, in fact, when we began the Bonobo and Congo Biodiversity Initiative. I had hooked up with some Congolese who had been studying here in the United States, and we decided that the greatest need for the bonobo was to find out where certain populations were. And there was this gigantic national park called the Salonga National Park, but no one knew whether bonobos existed there. So it was our intention then to send a team of Congolese in at the time to see if bonobos existed in this park, because that would really be fantastic for conservation if there was a giant national park which already in theory protected the bonobo. So in 97 that was our first mission. I wasn't in attendance in that mission. These were Congolese, and they went into a Belgian graduate student, Ellen van Kronkelsven at the time. I was in Kinshasa. We organized the mission. I stood on the banks, waved them off, and said, "See you in 2 months." And 2 months later, They came back with this fantastic news that bonobos were indeed, they found them frequently in the northern sector of the Salonga National Park.
And is this the only place in the whole world that bonobos live?
They live only in the country of the Democratic Republic
really?
Of Congo, and they occupy the center portion of the Congo, south of the Congo River. They are found outside of the Salonga National Park, but the Salonga National Park, I would say, holds the mother load. And it does so because Salonga is about four times the size of the Yellowstone National Park. It's equivalent of the size of Belgium.
Huge.
Yes, it's enormous. So it also, as we've been studying over the past 15 years, has ideal habitat for the bonobo. And because of its remoteness, it's virtually an intact ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
So with 1997, and we've been there ever since.
And you are doing extraordinary work because the conservation process also includes lifting the living of the people who live in the area. You're talking about people who are very poor, some of whom may hunt some endangered species or may be doing some burning techniques that will endanger the habitat of the bonobo and other animals as well. So this is a huge task that you have.
It is. It is, and it is inside and outside of the park. Our story began purely as a bonobo-centric. Let's find the bonobos, let's research the bonobos, see what they were doing, what was their conservation status. But quickly in this country, and it's a very, very wealthy country in terms of resources, but in terms of economic wealth for the majority of the people, it's one of the poorest on the planet. You couldn't work with bonobos and ignore people. You are a guest in the country, firstly. We were invited to come back to the Congo to provide financial support and technical expertise to work with the park guards. But law enforcement, and this is what we help bolster technically, is to help them find and run anti-poaching patrols. So we find the bonobo population, we beef up their anti-poaching capacity, the guards' anti-poaching capacity, but just enforcing the law is not going to reach the people who, in turn, are the poachers. And so these two things have to work dually. Enforcement of law must also at the same time work with poverty alleviation or giving people just simply opportunities and having them understand what might be some of the benefits of having the park. So we began working with the neighboring villages. I would say that would be about 2004. We needed our own food supplies and we needed a market. We had to feed teams of about 30 people. So I began just talking to the local chiefs and saying, you're doing the farming here. Can I buy eggs? Can we buy avocados? Can we buy chickens from you? Well, that was the initiation of what later became a farming cooperative, where it involved more and more villages, and we brought farming tools. We got a grant from the U.S. Embassy to really buy sufficient seeds and then hire an agriculturist, because I don't know much about farming. So we got local. All of this was supplied locally. And the farming cooperative continues today. And at one point, the people really suffered severely from malnutrition, because the years that I was there were also the war years of the Civil War. The war started in 1998. I couldn't go back until 2001. And it was shortly after that we started the farming cooperative. There were no seeds. People didn't have hoes or rakes or machetes. And so we started from bottom. They could only grow manioc at one point. There was malnutrition. But very gradually, they began to sow things like upland rice, soybeans. So not only did their diet improve from squash and beans and just a variety of foods, but there were also markets for soybeans, markets for dried beans, markets for some of the other variety of crops. Then afterwards, all of these things occurred by accident. Most of the guards that we worked with were illiterate. They could tell they were fantastic in the forest. They might know 300 to 400 species of trees, the indigenous name, but they couldn't communicate what they knew. Mm-hmm. And one of them said, well, you can give me money, but what I really would like to know is how to read and write.
Okay, the story gets more and more wonderful. Oh, my.
Well, we hired a teacher, and from there we started a school for the guards. And many of them can read and write today. But the villages were so enthralled with the school that as they would make their fishing trips and start selling the guards chickens and fish, they would also time it so they could sit in these classes. So one day I arrived, and the class was just jam-packed with people at my arrival. And I who are all these people in here? Oh, that's this fisherman, and it's that farmer over there, and it's this village guy from over there. And so I thought, well, in order to get the people out of the park and out of the camp, we'd have to open up a school there. So that's been wildly successful. It's mostly filled with women. There are about 150 students, and I would say 99% of them are women who bring their babies, and they all sit in their school, and they're learning how to read and write.
So what's the impact, what's the effect of having all those changes that you beautifully outlined on the bonobo?
Well, that's the number one question, and that's the many of these things are so difficult to measure, because you can't control for time as it goes by, and you have other problems arrive. Poaching is a real war on wildlife there. And as we began to see elephants returning to this area, we started becoming inundated with poachers. And these are not just little guys with their bow and arrow. There are those guys, too. Those primarily are from the villages. But these are people who come specifically to get ivory and to get elephant meat. And they'll take, they're paid in meat, so they'll take any kind of wild animal they can get, in addition to their main major objective, which would be to look for elephants. This made the place very, very insecure. And it made it also very difficult for us to judge whether our community programs were really having an impact. So if we, just aside from the very well-armed and highly equipped, well-equipped poachers that were coming in from the outside, if we just ignore them for a minute and just think about the population, the villages, to say, well, did all this farming really take a, did it have an impact? Are people going in less and less? Some of this has to do with our inability to measure what was their impact. Some of this has an inability to also determine who is in the park. And if family A is joining in the farming cooperative, are they in fact spending time in that farm, or does the husband of that family leave for several months and camp out in the forest? So it's extremely difficult. What we do know is that people have more money as a result. People haven't necessarily changed their ways. They still have an impact, a local impact on the park. The women slip off and do illegal fishing in the park because they can. So we do have to have wildlife law enforcement working at the same time. And just to say that a farming cooperative or alternative livelihoods, or it's going to include 100% of the people, those things take a long, long time.
Sure they do.
And a hunter loves to hunt.
Well, what does the hunter think of you, this woman who's come from Milwaukee, and you're there 6 months of the year, and you know the bonobos. You really know these intelligent, remarkable animals, and you have this conservation going on. Do they want to learn from you about all the knowledge you have about these creatures and about the chain of life and keeping some of them alive so we can keep them alive and who they are and our biological relationship, all of that? I would think that they would find you really intriguing, and you would be teaching them, too.
Well, they don't really think a whole lot about me. and that is the honest truth.
Really?
No. They think of the wonderful opportunities we might provide them, but you can only ask the question that you asked because you already have so much of what our culture has given you as background to ask that question. That's what you would imagine, because that's what you yourself would probably want from me.
Right.
But that is not what the Congolese in villages typically want. As I get to know them, though, I'm more interested and more informed about bit by bit of how they perceive their world and the wildlife in their world. It's not to say that they're insensitive about the lives of animals, because that's not true. I've taken hardened soldiers into the park in search of bonobos. Just join us on a bonobo survey, and they would be there either for security reasons or because they were bored sitting in camp. And they go along, and the first time they see a bonobo, they've had definitely an emotional reaction to that. And at that point, they probably want to know more. We really haven't done our job into providing more educational opportunities for the people to learn about bonobos, but this is gradually happening, gradually. What we are hoping to do is provide children the opportunity to go into the park, because they live right across the river from the park. They have never seen a bonobo. They've never seen an elephant. They're as ignorant about bonobos as most of our children here. Hmm. So this is something that we want to do in the future, and we want to do it in the very near future, and we must do it. It's taken this much time right now to build the trust and to build something that's consistent and steady. So the educational factor, I think, is extremely important, but at the same time, their opportunities for conservation is something that comes from having economic stability.
Mm-hmm. I understand that. And politically, are things dangerous there? Is it a good time for you to be able to do your work?
It's a good time.
It is.
Seems to be a good time. The danger comes from the poachers. The poachers usually are equipped with heavy military kind of arms, weapons, and ammunition, and they are backed by some fairly well-to-do people. But right now, most recently, we've had some interventions by the federal government, who sent a company of soldiers down to the park. And we've worked in collaboration with the military in a joint operation called Operation Bonobo. And Operation Bonobo has met with some success in that they have arrested a lot of our local poachers, certainly sent them on a wild run, and confiscated a lot of illegal weapons, because the illegal weapons pose the potential for rebellion in the future. So it's in the government's best interest to try and confiscate these weapons.
Oh, you've got so many issues going on with this, don't you? It's very complicated, very layered. We welcome phone calls. Let me give you, I just wanted Gay to tell the story, and she's only just begun, but I do want to involve the audience, too. Feel free to join our conversation. Gay Edwards-Reinartz is our guest. She is a zoologist, and she has done remarkable work with the bonobo and with the people who live in the vicinity of where the bonobos live, which is only one place on Earth, and that is the Democratic Republic of Congo. So she does half the year here. She is the program director of the Bonobo and Congo Biodiversity Initiative, and also conservation coordinator and bonobo coordinator for the Zoological Society of Milwaukee. Here's our number. We have yet to even get to the intelligence of the bonobos, which we will do, I assure you, in just a moment. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gay Edwards-Reinartz is our guest, and feel free to join the conversation if you'd like, 800-486-8655. We need to talk a little bit more now about the bonobos, and you were struck when you first saw one by their intelligence. Tell me more about that intelligence. How does it manifest itself? And what does it mean to be an intelligent bonobo?
Oh, that's a very difficult question for me, there are so many better people equipped who actually study bonobo intelligence and who study bonobos, their behavior, that are much more academically inclined in that direction than I have been. But it's no question that the bonobos are champions in figuring things out. Their cognitive abilities are remarkable. They have this fantastic sense of humor. I mean, I remember seeing a television program where a fellow was comparing all of the great apes, and he was talking about their personalities, and he just happened to be sitting behind, there was a scene behind him where there are all these bonobos in a sanctuary, I think. And they were just like particles in motion. They were just all over the place as this guy is trying to explain the difference between chimpanzees and bonobos. So they're extremely active, and they, but in terms of their intelligence, I don't know that they're necessarily more intelligent than I don't think things like that have been discovered yet. They certainly can figure out different in cognitive studies. There's of course the famous Kanzi, who I've had the pleasure of visiting before, where Kanzi, as a 4-year-old, learned, gosh, I think it was something like 200 to 300 words, human words. Our bonobos at the Milwaukee County Zoo, though without very much training in cognitive psychology, have been able to develop an amazing vocabulary. I couldn't tell you how many words, but differentiating color, making choices, solving puzzles, solving riddles that the scientists have put before them. They score extremely highly on most of these cognitive tests that they have. I wish I could tell you an anecdote, though, that would really put it in perspective. And I can't really think of one right now, except that one of them certainly shows empathy, and it's not something that I necessarily observed, but my friend Barbara Bell, who works at the zoo, as the bonobo keeper, tells me these fabulous stories all the time. When I'm in Congo, I don't get a chance to see the bonobos or observe them very much. They are poached, and so when we approach, we have about 3 or 4 seconds to see them before they're gone. But the bonobo, we had a fellow Lodi that I had helped import, and Lodi recently died, but he was an extremely empathetic bonobo. He was the papa of the group. Barbara aptly named him the president, and he was revered as being the president of the group. And Lodi could figure out, he knew that there was one of the bonobos, I believe it was Kitty, who could not open a certain, and I'm going to get the story wrong, but the gist is still the same, but there was a tube that was full of food, and I think it was somehow it was enclosed, and he knew that the blind and deaf Kitty would not be able to open this, or perhaps it was a younger individual who couldn't figure out how to open the tube to get to the food in the middle. So Lodi opens it for them adequately and solves the riddle of how to open this puzzle, but rather than taking the reward, dumps the reward on the floor for the other one to have.
Isn't that something? Empathy.
Yeah.
So where do we get this idea? And I wonder if we've just learned more about bonobos. I think part of the reason that people seem to be fascinated by them is sex. And we've heard that they live by this creed, make love, not war. We have subsequently learned that they are not entirely pacifists. But they do love each other.
Oh, yeah. And I you know, everything is on a scale. Everything is relative to something else. And I would say the sexual encounters and the sexual, the trading sex for ameliorating tensions by through sexual activities, that still applies. It definitely applies. But this idea that bonobos were make love, not war, and so therefore had no conflict whatsoever, that is what we're seeing is not necessarily the case. Nevertheless, I think bonobo societies have less. We don't know that they have the outright wars that chimpanzees have been trained to have, that Jane Goodall herself had witnessed with chimpanzees. We don't know that exists with bonobos. So their mechanism for controlling social tension is still prominently sex-based, but it's also a female-oriented society, and that's what makes it so interesting. and offers for humans slightly different model for us to consider our own evolution, and that there can be powerful males, and there can be at times a male dominance, but generally that is short-lived. Females joining in pairs or groups of females often come forward to challenge that male, and they can call the shots for a long, long time. So things like dominance is much more fluid in their society than it is in chimpanzee society or gorilla society.
Do we know why?
No, we don't, and that's, of course, the things that we're interested in. A lot of people have posed theories that they have more stable food in their environment, and that it has something to do with their feeding ecology, but the fact of the matter is we really don't know why there are those differences necessarily.
Tell me what it's like. I was asking you when we had a pause here if anybody's done a documentary, and I wish somebody would step forward and say that they want to document Gay's work, because it would be a fascinating. Somebody should be doing that, following you on one of these treks. But tell me what it's like to do one of those treks, how dangerous it is for you, how much time it takes, the rivers you have to cross, how long you're in the forest.
Well, it... the danger thing, that's relative too, but it doesn't feel dangerous. I'll just say that. It doesn't always feel dangerous. I mean, there are certainly risks, and I'll mention some of those, but we start off at the capital city, and then we move by commercial plane to where our base is in a town which sits right on the equator, and it's called Bandaka. And it's just one little horse town that you can buy most of your staples, but we really are in the cargo business, it seems like. Oftentimes, because we're bringing things from the States, from Belgium, from Kinshasa, and we're trying to move it using an infrastructure that barely exists of cargo and boats and so on. And then we move this cargo up the river to... up a series of rivers. We start off in the Congo in a dugout canoe, and we travel for about 3 days and three nights to Etate, which is our base in the park, and it's in the northern sector of the park. So that's all by river travel, but it's a beautiful journey. It's long, and it can be really, really hot, and you sit under parasols, or it can be really cold if it's raining. And so we go day and night, and we get to Etate, and there's our very comfortable camp. But it's primitive living. It's all camping. And then we have dormitories. We live in thatched structures. And from there, we go into the forest where we start our bonobo surveys, and that's pretty rugged conditions there, and those expeditions will take somewhere between 6 and 8 days.
Oh my.
And that's when we go with a group of about, well, it can be up to 12 people. We split off in 2 to 3 teams, though, and go different directions and try to, and we're in search of bonobos and elephants, and so we're going systematically through the forest to try to find out if we can see signs of these of bonobos and elephants and other mammals.
How do you keep
and humans?
How do you keep from getting lost?
Well, there we use satellite imagery. That's the planning that we must do before we do this. We use satellite images, and using GIS technology, we can plot where we want to go and make points on the map for our destinations, and then we put those into the GPS units. And we follow the GPS, and that's what we're teaching the guards to do as well, because there are no roads, there are no landmarks, and so that's the fun part about the work, because every place you go is really an exploration. What are we going to find here?
So it's not really the heart of darkness you're going into. You're going into the heart of, I don't even know what word to use to describe it. The heart of
the heart of the heart.
That's what it is, the heart of the heart.
Yeah, that's where we're going.
And have you been able, over the course of the years, to determine whether or not the bonobo population is lessening or is it growing? Do we know?
We are finding bonobos, and this is so encouraging. Well, where we live around Atate, those bonobos have been secure for the last 10 to 12 years. Hmm. Because of the presence of our research camp, as well as the guards that we train. But as you move away from Atate and we go further and further, the bonobos definitely are in zones of heavy poaching. But the fact that we're finding them and the numbers that we're finding them still says that the Salanga has a lot of bonobos. I think probably more than we had estimated earlier. So we're just putting some of the data together for one strip of land between the Salanga and the Yangia River, so we should have better estimates and very accurate estimates for the bonobo population. But we haven't found any break in the population. This is a strip of land that's going to cover about a fifth of the park. And as we are progressing further and further up river, the vegetation remains the same. We're also documenting the bonobo habitat. So the habitat remains the same. And even though the bonobos have some poaching pressures, they're still occurring without breaks, wide breaks that would actually say, that would define a different population because of some kind of physical barrier.
Interesting.
It is interesting.
Email from Judy from Racine wants to know if you were consulted by Lawrence Gonzalez for his book Lucy about primatologist Jenny Lowe studying bonobo chimpanzees deep in the Congo when she discovers Lucy, a new hybrid species, half human, half bonobo.
No, but I think my colleagues at the zoo were consulted. I'm pretty sure they were. A lot of that happened when I was in Congo. I'm familiar with the book, but I wasn't consulted. But I believe the zoo was, I think.
And tell me, let me get the phone number. You may be just fascinated by, as I am, by what Gay is saying, but feel free to join us. I don't want to neglect you. This is just an absorbing story. Our number is 800-486-8655. Tell me about the bonobos in Milwaukee. How many are here now and what programs are going on now that may relate to the Congo in Milwaukee? Or there are a lot of bonobos here compared to other zoos, aren't there?
Yeah, we have a very large group here. I'm going to probably give you a range. I think we have around 20 because I'm not sure exactly what the number is at our zoo currently. And the programs that all of us at the Milwaukee County Zoo are involved in one way or another about this. The people who work with the bonobos, we're all involved. We're all very close with each other, and we work simultaneously on the breeding program in North America for the bonobos, and I work in Congo. These are interrelated programs in a way, even though Congo is a bit out of town for sure, but
yes, I'd say so.
But there are, you know, there the to do conservation, you want to tackle all aspects. To do species conservation, you must tackle all aspects of the problem. I believe the veterinarians at the Milwaukee County Zoo know most about the bonobo, along with their colleagues. They know most about bonobo health than anybody else on the planet. Mm. And they are recommending now to other zoos how to take care of bonobos throughout the world, especially studying cardiac disease in the bonobo, which is the number one killer of bonobos. So one of these days, ostensibly, we'll be able to look at, if our program works, hopefully we'll be able to know the day that we can marry the two even closer, where we're looking at bonobo health in the wild and bonobo health here in the captive setting. That's just only one example. Many of the behavioral research that we do has application for conservation to some extent, and what we know of the bonobos here in terms of what is the species capable of, sets also the stage among us humans to be able to appreciate a species that has this sense of empathy. It's much more powerful to tell a story about an animal who shares so much with you and has this empathetic trait. It becomes even more necessary, I think, or it certainly stimulates more conservation effort mm-hmm. for a species like that.
Yeah. And let's go to Diane in Milwaukee. Hi, Diane.
Hello. I would like to know what they eat. Do they eat meat? Do they hunt for insects, or do they hunt for game?
Well, good question, Diane. They eat mostly pith. That's the inside of stems, leaves, fruits. Yes, they eat meat, but it's rarely. And as far as we know, they have the capacity to hunt. We do know that there have been bouts, and not where I've studied, but where the Germans have studied. The Max Planck Institute has a site. They have observed bonobos eating a small antelope, and I think probably a squirrel and possibly a monkey, but I do know the antelope. The guards have told me, these are the Salonga Park guards, have relayed stories where they thought that the bonobos were fishing and that they were slapping through the water and that something would land on the bank and they would pick those things up, and they thought they were small minnows. So that has yet to be confirmed by this particular modern scientist. But the guards are pretty darn observant, so I think.
Thank you, Diane, for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. We'll take more of your questions if you'd like to call and hear more from Gay in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, the Milwaukee Rep is currently performing To Kill a Mockingbird. It's a lovely production. I had the chance to see it on Sunday. And they actually don't need a whole lot of publicity because the crowds are huge for this and they have extended the run. But it's also part of this big read program that's going on. So there are a number of people in the community who are reading Harper Lee's work of genius and also seeing the play. We will have two of the actors, including Atticus, will be joining us. Lee Ernst, who plays Atticus, tomorrow during this time period to talk about what this is and why it endures and what it says about race in 2012 and what it said back when it was written and the beauty of the language. So that's tomorrow during this time period. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and the email is talk@wpr.org if you'd like to join our conversation. You mentioned empathy, and I was just thinking about elephants, too, because I've read some things that you've said about elephants and how it probably makes you weep to see the elephants who have been poached, who have been killed for their ivory, et cetera. Do you think that they have empathy as well, or they've been talked about as one of those animals that may be empathetic?
Yes, yes, they do, and I don't know that from personal experience, but I had the pleasure of hearing Franz De Waal speak in Madison this past
week. I love
weekend.
Him. He was in Madison.
Yeah,
He was a great guy.
In Madison, and I think that he gave ample evidence elephants certainly were one of the few species that actually recognized themselves in the mirror, so they certainly had a feeling or a sense of self-recognition, but which is one of the ingredients of developing empathy. But he, with his anecdotes as well as some of the tests that they have recently studied, that elephants have empathy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It must be wonderful to be very close to them, to look at them.
Well, again, I mean, we can see evidence of this when elephants have been poached. If the skeleton remains in place, we'll see that many elephant tracks now come around, are visible around that carcass. and in the area where the elephant that had died had been poached, had been either butchered or where the meat has been smoked. So it's something the elephants do come back and investigate routinely.
Hmm. Scott in Iron Mountain, Michigan. Hi, Scott.
Hello. I was just wondering if you get a lot of help from other countries. Is this a real big political problem, or do you get help through any kind of international organizations to help all these bonobos and whatever? Do you run into problems, or do you get help?
Well, thank you, Scott. We get help. We get financial help through USAID. Mm. The primary funder of our program, however, is the Zoological Society of Milwaukee. And if the Zoological Society of Milwaukee's program, we apply to grants, from internationally based grants, but we're also part of, Zoological Society is part of a consortium of organizations that work in the Congo to preserve the Congo's vast rainforest. And as part of that program, we extend that to bonobo and elephant conservation and large mammal conservation. So it is an international effort, and we do help each other and support each other through this, and simply makes it much more powerful than if one organization is out there struggling alone. Mm-hmm. So we do... We do benefit from the consortium. But most of our grants are U.S.-based, and most of our income comes from donors from this country and through the Zoological Society.
So if people went to Zoological Society, they'd be able to – we'll put that on our Facebook page, too.
Thank you.
Yeah. We'll do that when the show is over. And so you need the kindness of virtual strangers to be able to continue – your work, and in large measure, you need contributions.
Kindness of bonobo friends, yes.
Aww, the kindness of bonobo friends,
and they're real easily befriended, very easily befriended. Yeah.
I don't know where this was, but I was saying on the air before this hour, too, that I was looking at a video of you speaking, and you were showing video of this bonobo who was... Tell me the shoe story, who was putting on a pair of shoes. It was just, you know, if you didn't think that was your relative when you saw that,
that's
I don't know
right.
who you thought it was.
That's right. I think her name was Makisi, and Makisi is a bonobo youngster, young female, in the sanctuary, bonobo sanctuary in Kinshasa. And she was being cared for by a caretaker who wore pink Crocs on her feet. And Makisi was very interested in these pink Crocs, and one day slipped up and stole one of the pink and immediately climbed up into a tree. And Makisi at this point could have eaten those Crocs. She could have torn them up. She could have thrown them over her shoulder. But what she did instead was she put the pink Croc on her foot, and she wore it around all the rest of the day. They had trouble getting the pink Croc away from her, but she wore it on her foot. And you could see her at times putting her foot out and admiring her foot in different positions. And so that I think that story says everything about the intelligence of the bonobo.
Oh, it does.
And their sense of humor.
Yeah. Well, do you have pictures of all of this? I want to take this tour beyond, you know, I want to see the pit. I want to see what you're doing
I wish I had more pictures of things like Makisi, but I have only pictures of this incredibly gorgeous country and those wonderful people that I encounter that work with me.
Have a book? Gay? Is there a book? What is there?
Well, these are all great ideas, Kathleen. Well, we might as well say yes. Yes, it's in the making.
Okay. Because it should be. I'm sure there would be great interest in looking at this.
We have lots of pictures. And there is a, if people visit the Milwaukee County Zoo, there is a wonderful interpretive center that's rather new. It was donated by a real friend of the bonobos not too long ago. And she made it possible for you to have a small experience in the, as you enter the bonobo exhibit at the zoo, you'll see a cutout of me a much younger me, I might add. Written across my face is temporarily out of order, probably. But no, it says it, then there is a Paiute where that looks very much like our buildings in Edetate. And it's a wonderful little walkthrough, so you can get lots of information and see films there. Mm. And the kids can sit in a dugout canoe, and it gives a map of the region. Mm. Maps are important, so you see where you are.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you so much. It was just a pleasure to have you in studio. You're one of those, every now and then you meet somebody and you think, I'd really like to walk around in her shoes for a year. What you do must be just as interesting as anything could possibly be.
Well, it is interesting, and I've been blessed in that way. And I would love to have you come along with me, and you can do an oral history, and we could do it together.
I'm not as tough as you.
Oh,
you're tough. I'm not that tough anymore. But I would love it.
Take it as a compliment. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Gay Edwards-Reinert's our guest. And again, it's if you want to make contributions or learn more about the work, it's on our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. She does some remarkable work, doesn't she? We thank her for being with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios, about as far as the Congo as you could possibly be, I think, in downtown Milwaukee. But we thank her for bringing the Congo to us. We'll be with you again tomorrow starting at 9. Thanks for listening. Great conversations ahead.